Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
China has become more fixated on the US as its big rival. As Xi Jinping keeps saying, the West is declining, the East is rising. And by that, he means the US declining, China rising.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, the head of the National Security College at the Australian National University, and we're recording today's podcast from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay respects to their elders. So the topic for this episode of the National Security Podcast is the forthcoming visit to China by the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. And I'm joined by two very expert observers of the Australia-China relationship and the strategic landscape. It's a great privilege to welcome to the studio Richard Maud and Rowan Kallick. And for the benefit of listeners, Richard, for those who don't know him, is the Executive Director of Policy at the Asia Society Australia, but also has a distinguished career as a senior official and advisor in the Australian government, including as Deputy Secretary in Foreign Affairs and Trade, and indeed the Director General of the Australian Office of National Assessments. And Rowan Kallick holds a number of positions at the moment, including as an expert associate here at the National Security College, but also an industry fellow at Griffith University's Asia Institute, but is an eminent, if I can say that about journalists, a leading journalist and commentator on regional affairs over many years, looking not only at China but also at the Pacific. So it's great to have you both with me today. Richard, if I can start with you. Your expectations for the Prime Minister's visit, let's learn a little bit first about the context leading up to this visit. Why is the visit so important? What does it mark in the rather rocky journey of Australia-China relations?
Well, thanks, Rory. A pleasure to be here with you and Rowan. It has been a roller coaster over quite some many years now. So the visit is significant for a number of reasons. First is it's quite a long time since an Australian Prime Minister last got to Beijing. Malcolm Turnbull, way back in 2016, it almost seems like another era now, was the last Australian Prime Minister to visit China. So it's been a long time between drinks, and I think China remains exceptionally important partner for Australia, and even against the background of a very difficult relationship, it's important for Australian Prime Ministers to be able to visit China from time to time and talk directly with their counterparts. So it's significant in that context. And I think it's significant for a second reason. One is it probably marks to date the most significant indicator of the success of the government's desire to stabilize relations with China. So the Prime Minister is going with some work still to be done. There are definitely things that he and his government still want to achieve in the relationship, but quite a lot has been achieved in terms of getting political level dialogue going, getting officials level dialogue going, quite a lot of unwinding by China of the trade coercion that it employed against Australia, and of course with the wonderful news of the release of Cheng Lei.
Rowan, not looking for furious disagreement here, but it would be interesting if you've got your own take on why this visit matters? Does it matter as much as the government says it does?
Yes, it does. It comes at the end of this period, as Richard's been outlining, of stabilisation of the relationship from both sides. It almost comes at a time when people are bound to ask, what now? And interesting to read, for example, David Olson, the chairman, is it president of the Australia-China Business Council, saying, you know, we must move beyond stability. What can that be? What kind of vision is possible? It's difficult because China itself is in a somewhat volatile state. Strangely, we've seen the loss of unexplained loss of Foreign Minister Qin Gang and the Defense Minister Li Shangfu, and so on. So you build up relationships, the people disappear. It's not that easy to get a grip on a relationship with a volatile polity in which the party is gaining ever more ground in decision-making from the government there. There's lots of changes, which obviously China's entitled to do, but it's a challenge for all interlocutors. But we're on firmer ground now in terms that we are talking. It's got that context of the 50th anniversary of Gough Whitlam's first visit as Prime Minister.
And the establishment of the bilateral relationship, effectively.
That's right. It had happened a year before, the December before. We've gone through that 50th anniversary, but this is the first time that the Prime Minister had visited, and that's the anniversary coming up. And so clearly it's emblematic in the history of Australia, China, and of the Prime Minister's own party, the Labour Party, very important event. But important, I think, not to look back too much, because that's not so helpful. The situation is extremely different from what it was then, and extremely different from when Malcolm Turnbull, the previous Prime Minister who visited, he went to Shanghai, then Beijing. I was there, the visit. That was almost a routine type of encounter. Doesn't have this big weight of expectation that we have this time. But fortunately, as Richard explained, some of the steam and the pressure has come out of it because we've returned to talking some of those coercions, commercial and personal, have been removed. So what next? I'm not really sure about what next.
Let's come to expectations in a minute. And I want to go to expectations in terms of substance, but also expectations in terms of the style of the visit, what to watch for. But we'll come to that in a second. I just want to pick up on one point you made there, Rowan, which was just a reminder that it's not as if China has stood still during this time when Australia went through a period of great friction in the relationship with China. There could be an argument that China has its own reasons for wanting renewed dialogue with Australia, in addition to the fact that we have a government that has taken a very, very disciplined approach to the relationship and has sought to minimise any sense of provocation. What do you think, Rowan? Do you think China needs Australia now more than they did a few years ago, or is that simplistic?
I agree. I think it's looking for people it can talk to in an adult way. It's got these big problems with the United States. We've seen a series of measures taken by the US in terms of seeking to isolate China's tech sector, which in some ways has been its most successful sector internationally, albeit constrained by political decision-making inside China, which has disrupted that process. China has become more fixated on the US as its big rival, as it as Xi Jinping keeps saying, the West is declining, the East is rising, and by that he means, in his mind, the US declining, China rising, and frustration that this isn't happening as fast or as much in a globally recognized manner as he might have hoped. And Australia, being perceived as a Western country, is one that, again, China feels it can talk to. It has this important economic relationship of codependency, and that ties us together. There's hopes always in China that we might be persuaded to move a little away from the US, and I'm pretty sure that the Prime Minister won't be walking down that path.
We're moving to expectations. Richard, before you maybe talk about what you expect from the visit, what's your view on that point of context? I mean, is China extremely confident in the way it's engaging with Australia, or is there some quiet, if you like, sense of need on their part that, that China actually needs Australia to be a more cooperative interlocutor?
I think it'd be a bold call to say that China needs Australia to be a more cooperative partner. I think Rowan's absolutely right that they would like us to be a more cooperative partner. And they say they don't really understand why we're not. The Chinese system is fond of saying that there's no reason why China and Australia shouldn't be able to get on. We're not great power adversaries. We don't share a disputed border. We don't have a relationship freighted with historical trauma. And of course, part of that narrative is a refusal or a disinclination to engage on genuine Australian concerns about China's conduct towards us. They tend to think that if only we just stopped being hysterical, quote unquote, and following the in the footsteps of the United States, we could all perfectly get on. And therein lies one of the kind of central dilemmas of the relationship, because for all the stabilization, the two sides do talk past each other, and that puts inevitable limits. So I think one opening point about expectations is stabilization's come quite a long way, as I said. There's still room to do some more. We can get to specific outcomes that might come, but there's still an opportunity, I think, to keep incrementally developing a fuller, more rounded, less hostile relationship within the boundaries of stabilization. But I think, you know, the government itself understands the limits, the inherent limits to the relationship, the boundaries to the relationship, which are posed not by any sense that Australia wants to prevent China's rise or to participate in a US-led effort to contain and suppress it, to paraphrase Xi Jinping. You know, Australia wants a good relationship with China, but the boundaries, the constraints are really driven by China's conduct and the nature of the party state that has now emerged.
So be direct on this. What are your expectations, or what do you think should be realistic expectations from the Australian government for the outcomes of the visit?
Well, clearly the government would like a couple more shoes to drop on the trade front. So wine is obviously the big one. The trade minister said the other day that Australia had gone from having roughly $20 billion worth of trade under one form of action or another down to about $2 billion worth of trade. So that's already a big drop. But there are a couple of problems still remaining. Wine is one, lobster is one, a little bit on the meat front. Wine's a big one. Some of the wine growers have been hurting. The trade minister has said recently that he hopes to speak to his Chinese counterpart in the next couple of weeks. So that may be a soft signal that perhaps around the visit, you know, either during or slightly before or slightly after, we will get an outcome on wine. There is media reporting that the WTO panel has handed their draft report to both sides. And if it is as favourable to Australia as the government had hoped, then the opportunity is to follow the Bali model and to give China a bit of space, face-saving space, to drop those measures. So trade is one. There are still some elements of what you might call the normal back and forth, if you can call anything normal these days, of the bilateral relationship yet to be established. We had a thing called the CEO Roundtable. We haven't had one of those for a while. We haven't had very senior business delegations get into China more regularly. We haven't gone back to talking about climate and clean energy. So some of that functional cooperation where there might be space to do things with China that benefit both parties would be good. You alluded to this earlier, Rory, but there's still an Australian detained in very unjust circumstances, Yang Hengjun. So I'm sure the Prime Minister will advocate on his part privately, as he should, but directly to the President. There's a series of quite difficult issues that the Prime Minister will have to mention. I'm sure he will, although getting a real discussion on them is hard. But we have, as you know, many concerns about China's pressure on Taiwan at the moment, about its very assertive actions in the South China Sea, its partnership with Russia on the Ukraine war, human rights, of course. So, you know, I think if the PM can come away with some positive news on trade, or at least foreshadowing it, if there is a little bit more on the sinews of the relationship, you know, repairing them, then in my mind, that's a good outcome, because getting there in itself is an achievement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to my mind, Australia, the Prime Minister and the government, they don't need a lot more than that.
On the strategic context, I think you've mentioned already the risk-taking behaviour, or the deliberate threat behaviour, or seemingly threatening behaviour of China towards Taiwan and in other contexts, the South China Sea and so forth. Do you think that Australian dialogue with China on those issues, you know, so-called confidence-building measures or guardrails, or ways to minimise risks of conflict escalation, do you think that will be a substantial part of the visit, or just really the beginning of a conversation?
The Prime Minister has talked often, as has Penny Wong, about both the United States and China as great powers having special responsibilities, in particular to avoid stumbling into war that would be disastrous for us all. Both the Minister and the Prime Minister have talked about the need for risk reduction measures. I think risk reduction seems to be the term that's now replaced.
Guardrails have quietly slipped away.
In the region, and, you know, no doubt the Prime Minister will encourage that, including encouraging China to get back into regular defence dialogues, a dialogue with the United States. It's an extremely difficult argument to prosecute, because China is not really interested in Cold War-style risk reduction measures, doesn't really even like hotlines, you know, let alone incident at sea agreements or in the air, because as the Chinese defence minister, now departed, said at the Shangri-La dialogue, the problem will go away if America and America's allies and partners just stay away from China.
Yeah,
stay out of the Taiwan Strait, stay out of the South China Sea. So the problem as they see it is that confidence-building measures will legitimise, maybe even encourage, US behaviour that they, China, regards as provocative. So that's the problem, and no one's yet quite found a way to cut through that.
Yeah, and accordingly, China seems to be using risk as actually one of its strategies. Rowan, your expectations in substance, but also then I would love to hear from you on what you expect in terms of the style, the look and the feel of the visit, and what that symbolically could mean.
Yes, good question, Rory. I think it's very important to establish that at the start, to quash any sense of this being a tributary-style relationship. Xi Jinping has curtailed his international travel and is instead more waiting for foreign leaders to come to him. And one has seen in the past leaders walk the red carpet inside the Great Hall of the People, come to Xi and not being sure what to do, very often they bow. Xi never bows back. He rarely even looks at them. And, you know, he has this expression that Richard has written about of weary forbearance. So I don't think our Prime Minister should take this personally. This is just a general thing. But I think he needs to look him in the eye, shake his hand, and this is a meeting of equals in some ways and not one of an emperor talking to someone from a distant land. I think it's quite important to establish that, and I'm confident our Prime Minister is well aware and will prosecute that well. I think that it's important that he is fairly bold in talking out in ways that Richard has talked about, in ways that will help act as a deterrence to any inclination on Xi's part to push further into militarization of the South China Sea, causing even further alarms with the Philippines, our new strategic alliance partner, and with and across the Taiwan Strait, of course. These meetings are particularly important because the decision-making body at the peak of the party is a black box. We really don't know much about who's around Xi as decisions are made, the process of this. He's the chair of leading small groups that form policy. We really don't know how these processes work in any clarity. So when we have the chance, not only us, but our international partners, it's important to speak clearly to those top people. And Xi is the top in China. He's the paramount leader, the most powerful since Mao Zedong, and explain why we hold our views and hold our concerns about the risks that we're entering into our region. I think that's very important. China's is called by an academic friend of mine, Zhu Feng, as a lonely rising power. So it hasn't got many people, many national leaders who are going to tell him the home truths. Vladimir Putin is currently in, as we're holding this conversation, in Beijing.
It doesn't look so lonely if you look at the BRI summit.
No, but I don't think we're going to hear many home truths from those people. They're mainly petitioners looking for a continuation of loans, and they're going to be disappointed in many cases.
Just still on the the symbolic element of the visit. Is there anything else, Rowan, from your experience of being a China watcher and living in China, of seeing how the system operates? Is there anything else that the Australian government should be watching for, careful about, things to avoid, things to recommend against?
I think one of the things to recommend is touch onto the personal when you can with a leader like Xi Jinping. He's visited every Australian state. His last visit, he went to Tasmania and completed the a lot of Australians have not visited every Australian state. And I think having some personal notes about Xi's visits here and so on, I think trying to build up some kind of accord is a good thing to do. I think in terms of what we can ask for, I think we should ask to go back to the principles from which we formed our free trade agreement. With all this commercial coercion, not too many people have gone back to that. And I think it's important to say, let's go back there, both sides, and let's recommit to that and to the principles. It was a reasonably comprehensive agreement, but politically charged decision-making by Beijing has fractured that and fractured confidence in it. And I think we should restore in full those annual dialogues. And again, Richard mentioned some. There's a whole suite of them at a political level as well that we would like China to recommit to, partly for those reasons that it's important to have plain speaking at the top levels when we can, not only on our behalf, but on the behalf of our partners and friends who may feel under pressure from China today.
We'll be right back.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Richard, you've been a Prime Ministerial Advisor. What are your do's and don'ts for the visit?
Well, I was smiling as Rowan was talking because I did accompany Julia Gillard to Beijing when she visited, and there's a photo of me shaking hands with Xi Jinping as I was introduced in the lineup, and my body is at an angle. So he was standing so far away that he almost forced, you know, that kind of signal of deference that Rowan was talking about. Yeah, look, I think offering advice to prime ministers is always hazardous, and he's got plenty of really good China expertise around him, including Jan Adams, and excellent ambassador as well. So he probably doesn't need my advice, but a couple of thoughts. One is, you know, China does look for opportunities with visits like this to try and portray the visit as somehow the country in question splitting away from America. So, you know, it likes to try and paint a picture of division within what you might call the Western alliance when it comes to dealing with China. So try and make it look like France and Germany, for example, are departing from the new, somewhat tougher line that Brussels is setting on Europe, or New Zealand is different to everyone. So that's a pretty obvious trap, and one that I'm sure the PM will be advised to avoid. It just requires a bit of care and not to be verbal if you can. I think the other one is that you know, it'd be interesting to know how long the meeting with Xi Jinping is, because often they use consecutive translation. If they do use consecutive translation, however long your meeting is, it's instantly halved. Mm. So sometimes you have less time than you think, not just to get across your main points, but to try and actually get into that conversation that might connect, that Rowan talked about. Talking to Chinese senior officials and ministers and even leaders is often very hard. You know, often they have their talking points, they won't depart from them, they won't engage with the idea that China bears any responsibility for the collapse in relations, not just between China and Australia, but the dramatic collapse in trust that we're seeing across the West and indeed in countries like India. So, you know, it can be hard, but if there's enough time and you have your plan of attack for the main bilateral meeting set out, then hopefully the PM can connect.
Can I just butt in here. Just two more don'ts and two more do's. One is, I think it's important that we try to return to a form of bipartisanship on China policy and ideally in many other areas of foreign policy. And the Beijing narrative has been developed that, and I've had this confirmed by meetings with people who've come from China. We've had quite a suite of visitors from Chinese think tanks and other places in the last year. The narrative has developed that Australians voted a Labour government in order to vote also for China. And I think that because the coalition is anti-China, and I think it's a perilous thing for that view to be perceived to gain any kind of acknowledgement by our own government. I think just a straight bat, as it were, to that kind of thing is very important. And generally, it would be good for us to see more of a return to bipartisanship at home, which needs to be cobbled together. And another no, I think, is a no return to the formal human rights dialogue that we had before, which was a kind of a containment of our capacity to raise human rights issues. They were then confined to an afternoon's conversation, which rarely or maybe never really led anywhere. I think that's an unnecessary constraint. But positive things, this is a very a weird one, but I do think that there is room for us to do things together with the Pacific Islands. And
sorry, you mean Australia and China to collaborate in the Pacific?
Yes, in development areas. And I think that China's development policies there have not been as effective or as helpful as they could be. And they may well be perceived to be aimed at achieving contrary aims to our own. But I think insofar as there is a desire to actually help Pacific people to grow their own economies and live better lives, it would be an interesting thing to see if there's any, it would have to be acknowledged from the top, any capacity for us to work together. That might also undermine some of that suspiciousness and increasing rivalry that we're seeing, which is not helping anyone. It's not helping us, not helping China, not helping Pacific Islands. It's just making development biddable. And I think the other thing I'd like to see is more commitment to joint research in areas like medical research, including infectious disease, ailments of the elderly. There's things where we work together with our institutions, with Chinese institutions, to have some kind of blessing from Xi. We could do more for the benefit of both.
And presumably doing all of that with our national security eyes open. It's interesting, Rowan, that you suggest that collaboration in the Pacific, because although the current Australian government has been more disciplined in its rhetoric towards China broadly in the relationship, it's also worked very hard, I would say, to limit China's influence in the Pacific. So I don't think there's a great deal of trust there.
Yes, that's true, of course.
There's a global context, and you've both alluded to it, and I think, Richard, you mentioned earlier that it's not as if the frictions and the distrust in the China-Australia relationship is somehow unique. You know, you mentioned India, you mentioned the United States, but we could also talk about Japan, the Philippines, Vietnam, Europe. It's a long list. Other countries will be watching this visit closely, and of course, the Prime Minister will be visiting China during a season of international travel. He'll also be going twice to the United States. He'll also be going to the Pacific Islands Forum, and one of his trips to the US will be to APEC. So many eyes will be on Australia, partly with that question of what are we doing? Are we stabilising? Are we going further than a stabilisation? Are we being broken away from some sort of solidarity, or are we effectively reinforcing to China the terms of the relationship? What are your views on those other observers and what they might take away, whether it's the United States or others?
Yes, you're right, Roy. The visit will be closely watched. You know, I think I would probably say to those people outside of Australia from other countries watching the visit is that Australia is simply returning to the type of relationship with China that most of those other countries enjoy. So, you know, the United States visits China regularly, not at the presidential level to be sure, but certainly very senior ministers have been through Beijing routinely recently. That Europe sends its most senior leaders. Japan has high-level dialogue and an enormous economic relationship with China. So we are just simply trying to claw back some ground after some very difficult years. I don't think it indicates in any sense a loss of realism about what China is or the risks that are either real and apparent now or potential that China poses to us. And I think one interesting thing about the juxtaposition, the closeness of the Prime Minister's visits, state visit to Washington and then not long after a visit to Beijing, is that in a way you will see two sides of foreign policy that, you know, they do have a certain tension to them, which the Chinese media likes to point out to Australia. You know, you're back to having your cake and eat it too. But the government's been intent on stabilisation. It's tried to take some of the heat out of the rhetoric on China domestically. It's tried to the extent one can, take a little bit of the politics out of the relationship with China. But it's also continued, as you know, Rory, most of, if not nearly all, of the policy framework for managing China risks, whether they're domestic or foreign, that it inherited from the coalition. And I can't speak for the government on this, but one presumes that they've done so because they see it as a necessary adjustment to the way in which China has changed, a phrase that the foreign minister herself used. And in some cases, the government's doubled down on some of those elements. So if you look at the way in, if you look at the Defence Strategic Review, the government's emphasis on deterrence in their response to that document, the support for the nuclear-powered submarines, the strong support for force posture initiatives with the United States, the investment in the Quad, and so on it goes. So, you know, you can look at all those policies and see a government that still very much sees the need to manage and hedge against risks from China, and they're matching it with an diplomacy. So the Prime Minister talks about diplomacy and deterrence as being the twin parts of the government's approach.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask you to begin thinking about how this visit may be seen a year from now or a few years from now, where it will sit in the you know, the long journey of Australia-China relations and the dynamics of really stability in the Indo-Pacific region. There is, as we said at the outset, a pretty powerful regional and global context, a pretty disturbing context. We're recording this interview at a time where there's now conflict unfolding in the Middle East following the horrific attack on Israel by Hamas, and now the response by Israel into Gaza, which could itself drive further escalation and is already driving further bloodshed. The war in Ukraine is continuing after Russia's invasion last year. The risks of conflict here in the Indo-Pacific, the risks of confrontation, many of those risks based around the decisions that the Chinese leadership will make. So even in a best-case scenario, the Australia-China relationship a year or two or three from now is going to be in this pretty fragile global environment. Therefore, I guess as a parting question, I'd ask each of you, and I'll go to you first, Rowan, how do you see this in that long arc?
I think it's going to be a matter of setting aside a period of instability, and the big question is, where to now? Will the Prime Minister be outlining a new step for the relationship, or will he keep that in reserve? I think that's a quite legitimate thing for us to do at this time, to re-establish the relationship as was, bearing in mind we've got nothing to be grateful about for China restoring trade, for example, that it has wrongly barred us from. So I don't think any gratitude is called for, but putting things back in place is the first thing that he can do and will be doing. I'm not sure this is the time for suggesting a new path. I think that may have to wait, and have to wait discussion with our friends. And we're talking ever more closely, as you just alluded to, with partners in Quad, in AUKUS, and so on. And I think that will have to emerge, and best done in partnership, you know, and even in terms of the biggest threat, the danger across the Taiwan Strait. Important for us not to get caught up in reaffirming the one China policy. Obviously, Australia has its own policy, which is not the same as China's. Not much value in the Prime Minister and President Xi, you know, arguing the toss about that. That will really get nowhere. But I think in terms of the communique that comes out of this, important that we don't put ourselves there, because we want to leave ourselves space to do what we can to preserve the status quo across the Taiwan Strait, that this terrific democracy that's in power there can continue to thrive. And so I'm going back to the beginning of our conversation, limited expectations, but nicely putting to bed a bad period for both countries, and let's get on with dealing with each other as adults in the future. But in terms of a big China vision, let's wait until we've talked to our friends after the visit.
Richard, any closing thought from you on how we'll look back on this?
Well, I think the visit comes at a time when, despite that collapse of trust that I mentioned across the West, the rising concern about China's conduct internationally, the risks that are building in the international system, that the West, including the United States, has not completely given up on China and believes that disconnecting to a significant degree is undesirable, potentially carries its own risks, and probably not possible. And I think we should see the visit by the Prime Minister, and, you know, at a very big level in that context. We're now in a world where competition between US and China, and to some extent between China and the rest of us, is hardwired into the system. We've got a China that in many respects is going in the wrong direction faster. But we are hanging in there, talking to them, and trying to, where we can, influence China. The Prime Minister has said on a number of occasions that his government puts dialogue with China at the heart of efforts to stabilize the relations. And China has had its own reasons and motivations for warming the relationship, but I think you could say that dialogue has produced outcomes that benefit Australian national interests. But what we haven't been able to do, nor America nor Europe yet, is to really cut through that Chinese mindset about the world, that the world is, particularly, or the West is, inimically hostile to China's rise, will never accept China as a peer competitor, and that China is blameless in his conduct. So what we really need to do while we're hedging against those risks, is to keep trying to cut through that barrier.
I wonder how much chance we've ever got of doing that, though, Richard, given that for all the decades of engagement leading up to, you know, the rupture of a few years ago, throughout that period, the evidence is that the Chinese system still felt that there was never going to be trust.
I think the chances are very low, certainly at the strategic level, if you like, in terms of China's outlook for at least as long as it's far ahead as it's sensible to look. But I do think we can probably have influence collectively at the tactical level, and we should try for that, and especially over Taiwan, for example. And I don't think we have much choice to keep trying. That's point A. Point B, we're not sitting on our hands while we're trying, right? We are into deterrence big time. We are into managing risk big time. We are into protecting national interests. So that's the other part of the equation.
That's a good note to conclude on, because, of course, if you go back to the, I think, the very elegant three-point articulation of government policy on China about cooperating where we can, differing where we must, and always working in Australia's national interests, sounds like that's informed this conversation today. So thank you.
Can I just interrupt
yes.
you, Rory,
yeah,
just
sure.
to say one thing?
Keep
one,
it going.
I think the Prime Minister might, with some find some value in getting on the phone to a former Labor Prime Minister to talk about his upcoming visit.
You're not going to name any names?
Oh, I leave it to the listeners, the PEG podcast, to imagine who that might be. But I think that will be he will, of course, be doing that. But I'm just saying, I think that person has some pretty pretty well-researched thoughts on this subject. Thank you.
Well-researched. There's a clue. All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Rowan Callick and Richard Maud.
Thanks, Rory.
Thank you, Rory. Terrific.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.